This is Unsolved, True Crime in Western New York, where we dive deep into cold cases and unsolved crime in the Western New York region. I'm Leanne Stuck. Today we are talking to the founder of Cold Case Consultants of America, a national organization that works to solve cold cases. So it's a great conversation about what they do and how they do it. We even get the scoop on a big breakthrough that they made in a case that will soon lead to an exoneration. And we're going to get the details on a case they're digging into out of Rochester. So let's get right to it. Take a listen. Well, I'm excited to introduce you all to Alex Baber. He and his wife, Jaylin, are a husband and wife investigative team that are working to solve unsolved homicide cases across the nation. The two founded Cold Case Consultants of America. And I'm excited for you to get to hear all about their efforts to try and bring families justice nationwide, which of course is something that we are very passionate about here on this podcast. So Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
So if my understanding is correct, there are more than 250,000 cold cases in America right now, which is honestly mind-boggling. From your perspective, I'm sure that's what kind of brought the fuel to fire to create your business.
Actually, it was. When I found out the statistics just from 1980 alone being over a quarter of a million homicide cold cases, that doesn't include abductions and disappearances, but strictly homicides, it was staggering.
So talk to me a little bit about first your background. What brought you to this point of deciding I'm going to do something about the number of unsolved homicides in America and I'm going to create this Cold Case Consultants of America?
My background is one of being a diplomatic security detail operative. I did protective services for a lot of people that flew in from overseas, political figures. My wife, her background being in forensic science, cyber forensics, and now forensic psychology, has kind of fueled us. My wife was a victim in 2004. She was abducted, dropped off on a sidewalk with nothing but a sheet and left for dead after a week. And she kind of recovered from that, of course, and that fueled her fire to get to where we are today, along with my background and, you know, having the things that I've worked with, seeing the corruption that's out there just in general society. You know, we live in a cynical world, and we just figured it was time for somebody to step up and do something.
Alex, if you're comfortable, I'm going to have you just backtrack for a moment. Your wife was a victim of crime. What happened, and how was she taking that and fueling it into what you guys do now?
Well, she was abducted, dropped off on the sidewalk after a week with nothing but a sheet and left for dead. And she, they never identified her perpetrators. They never were able to do anything at all with the case, literally. So it kind of faded away into a file, much like these cases we're discussing today. And, you know, she turned around and used that as fuel. She joined the Air Force, became an MP, military police, became a dog handler, worked with Air Force One with the president, transferred over to a PSYOPs in the Army, and she's just driven. She's a hell of a woman.
Have you tried to solve your wife's case?
We have. We've looked into it, unfortunately, with the records being not as thorough as we had hoped. The initial investigation was not up to par by my standard. So therefore, you know, being almost 20 years later, it's very difficult to go back in time if the initial investigators do not do their job in a proper manner.
And you pretty much mentioned this a little bit, but for those who are involved in this unsolved crime world and have passion to try and solve these cold cases, it takes a certain type of person. Talk to me about where your passion comes from yourself to try and help these families. I mean, for me, starting this podcast was just the fact of I kept reporting on cases that were going unsolved and talking to families that were just begging for justice. And I have found that the more people who know about a case, you never know what they know and could come forward and try and help it. But for you, where does your passion come from?
My origins begin in my younger years. I grew up in the 1980s as a young man, a teenager. And at that time, you know, all the shows that were being aired on the TV and the movies that were being put out is all about, you know, heroics and the good guy always wins in the end. That's my mindset. That's how I was, mentally, formed created at a young age to where I just felt that's the way the world needs to be. So as I grew older, I started to pursue some of my dreams, and this being one of them, of course. But it's, you know, when you get into it with the victims and their families, it's a whole nother level. When reality sets in, you sit down with a mother or a father, daughter or son, sister, brother, aunt, cousin, grandparent that has lost somebody, it's very tragic. And when they break down to you, you're on a whole nother level. They kind of give you a piece of them. And in turn, you give them a piece of you, and that drives you. That gets you up every day to put you on point to do what needs to be done, to identify, to track, and hunt these people down that are out there that's evaded justice.
I understand that completely. And Alex, I gotta ask you, this past summer, everyone's eyes were on the Gabby Petito and Brian Laundrie case. When that was unfolding, were you following what was happening with that case?
To some extent, I wasn't really following as others that I know were. I kind of stay out of the current news and media as much as possible. I focus more on the cases that I have on my table, ones that where the victims' families have reached out to me, and I've got my teeth into and trying to do something because there's so much going on at once. But I am familiar with the case, yes.
As that was happening, I mean, the sheer amount of media attention, the amount of interest, the amount of social media that was being spread about that case for somebody who really has dedicated his life to solving cold cases, what does that sort of attention mean to try and getting a case solved?
It makes the biggest difference in the world. It's individuals like yourself, the main media, the social media platforms that are able to get this kind of information out in front of everybody, whether it be on a TV or radio, you know, somebody driving to work, somebody sitting around a break room, you know, it's out there and it needs to be out there. People need to know what's going on. And, you know, with this case, it took off like wildfire. And we were able to, you know, us being the community, were able to come together and work in collective as a collective and give some information here that ultimately led to locating the two individuals, unfortunately.
And it also too, I mean, just having the coverage on that case and the manhunt for Brian Laundrie and searching for Gabby Petito at the time, it just brought about and discovered other cold cases as well and other missing people.
That is correct. There's that this typically happens when you have such a mass search effort that's initiated in this kind of a situation. You typically find other remains, especially when you're searching in the areas they were searching. It's sad to say that, but if you go back and you research, this is not the first time this has happened.
Do you feel that there could be another side to that coin of having a case have so much attention and so much involvement that it could hinder law enforcement who are trying to investigate? Or do you think that it really only is a positive to try and get the word out?
There's always two sides to the coin. With this one here, it was beneficial in a rather quick and efficient manner. But there is times that the law enforcement needs to keep the information and evidence close to their chest. There's something called guilty evidence. And if there's information that's released to the public domain and anybody can get online and read this or research this, there's always people out there that are not of right mind, and they'll do whatever they can for attention. They'll try to manipulate the situation. All this does is harm the investigation and ultimately harm the victim and their families.
So getting back to what you do with the Cold Case Consultants of America. Talk to me about the difference from what somebody may do at law enforcement versus what you're able to do in your office for these cases.
Well, the nationally, there is over 19,000 agencies for law enforcement. And of those, only 7% have a cold case squad. That number is really hard to wrap my mind around. That kind of explains the situation we have today with the 250,000 cases that are filed away as cold cases and aren't really being looked upon. With our company, our agency, what we do is we have some of the best in their fields. We have Kurt Baggett, the number one forensic document examiner in the nation, quite possibly the world. We have Dr. Arpad Voss, who's one of the leading forensic anthropologists. We also have Detective Patrick Napoleon from Atlanta, who has so many accommodations. I'd sit here all day naming them. He's highly decorated and respected. And we have Hall of Fame inductee and reporter Joe Cochran, who's a member of the team also, who's a docetarian for our company. And with each of these, what we do is we'll take a case and we'll go down to the facts. So we get down to the foundation, back to square one, before we have people's opinions or assumptions injected. When we do this, we locate the hard evidence, and then we branch out, each doing their own part in the investigation, and we come back together and assemble collective minds. And we usually, we've been very, very lucky, that's a word I want to use here, in uncovering new evidence in a lot of these old cold cases. We have a lot of big releases that are coming out in the next month to 6 weeks on a lot of notorious cases. And we have new forensic evidence that we've been able to identify with the new technology that's available. And we're literally rewriting history is what we're told. So we have some big news coming out, but our agency and our IT, which is our investigative team, they're the best at what they do for a reason.
How is it that you select one case to do over another? Do victims' families reach out to you asking, can you look at my son's case? Can you look at my, husband's case, whatever it might be? Or do you find these cases that you think you can make a difference in and take the time and put time investment into it?
Well, we've never turned anybody away. That's something I'm very proud of. Since we've gone national here in the last couple months, we've had many victims' families reach out to us, and we've been able to assist them, and we're working on the cases currently. Our policy is that we do not accept money from victims' families. We don't accept money from law enforcement agencies. We have our own private investors and funding. We do this, therefore, there's no influence over our decisions. We want to make sure that we're 100% accurate and on point, and whatever we do uncover is not motivated or manipulated by an outside source.
And how does it work in terms of getting the evidence from the case, looking at the case files, being able to run DNA if you need to do that? Do you guys have the ability and access to do that to try and solve these cases?
Absolutely. We have three third-party companies out there that work with us that we're able to get what we need done. And when we do, we reach out to the best that's out there, whether it be audio analysis, DNA, whatever forensic category we need to have looked at for the evidence, we have the option available to us.
Are you able to give us a sneak peek at all into what cases you are working on right now? And I know you had mentioned something coming out soon of big releases, I believe you said. Are there breakthroughs coming up in some of the cases you're working on?
Absolutely. I'll give you a small one we're going to be doing next week. I don't want to ruin it because we have one of the big stations that's doing the story for us. But the lipstick killer of Chicago, 1945-46, a gentleman by the name of William Hirons, was persecuted by the media, incarcerated. He was the longest serving inmate in Chicago, Illinois history, actually, at 65 plus years. We were able to, using our database, we created a singular letter database for linguistics. And with over 500 letters that we've collected from serial killers and anonymous writers over the last, 70 years. And the linguistics part of this and the cross comparison, looking at, the syntax and the information that's within the letters, the postal stamps, the dates, the location, this has been able to give us an upper hand. And with doing this, we were able to identify the actual perpetrator of these crimes, proving that William Hirons was in fact innocent. So we're about to exonerate this man.
Wow, that's incredible.
It is. We're excited. You know, we have a late imprint match from Mrs. Brown's door jam, the bloody print. We were able to identify the individual who left that print. It was not William Hirons. And for years, a lot of people have speculated and, you know, have believed in Mr. Hirons, that he was innocent. He passed away in March of 2012. It's a shame that this man's life was taken from him. And it was influenced by the media back then. There was a young girl that was involved, 6 years old, that was mutilated. It's a very sad story, along with two other women, Josephine Ross and Miss Frances Brown. But we're finally able to bring justice and truth to the case, you know, to the public, to light, and clear this man's name. He may be gone, but he will never be forgotten.
That is exactly why you do what you do, to be able to have this moment. Is this the first moment that you've had since starting the Consultants of America that you've been able to bring a family justice, bring a person justice, exonerate somebody?
This is, it's not behind closed doors, because we have like three more big releases we're going to be doing again in the next month to 6 weeks. I've been working on these cases for 14 years behind closed doors. And all through these years, I've been able to meet with the victims' families, been able to gather their information, their personal evidence, along with, of course, you have FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, which gives us access to a lot of the files, unless they're open cases. But we've been able to get the files in the open cases, too, from previous detectives that have retired or have passed on. Their families have given us access to their personal files. You know, this is what's going on here. It's definitely a divine movement. This isn't just us, you know, doing hard work and remain focused. It's the fact that, you know, there's things coming together here that I can't explain, and the doors have opened for us. Opportunities have been presented, and we're being able to serve some justice here. It's long overdue. You know, law enforcement has been taking it on the chin for the last 40-45 years. You know, every year annually these cases build up, they increase, and they're not getting the funding. The federal and state government has to step up. They have to allocate funds to these agencies so that they can have detectives. Even if they do not have a cold case squad, they should at least have one detective that is allocated, and his job is to work on these cases, you know, 24/7 or 5 days a week, whatever, you know, whatever his work shift may be. But he needs to focus strictly on cold cases, because they're compiling, they're growing annually. And in order to do that, they need funding. So, you know, people need to reach out to their representative, to their governor, you know, the city mayor, get anybody and everybody they possibly can involved to help these agencies.
And that too, kind of bringing it to what we see in the city of Buffalo, for those who are listening and are from Buffalo, our Buffalo Police Department has two cold case unit officers, which is a new development within the last 5 to 6 years, that they had two officers. And many people who I've spoken to, many victims' families, have said that isn't enough. There are hundreds and hundreds of cold cases, and to have two people is just not enough manpower. So that definitely correlates to what we're seeing here in, you know, a medium-sized city in Buffalo.
It's like this around the nation. The smaller towns, smaller local townships, cities, one's enough, because typically they do not have the high violence or, you know, homicide rate. But the bigger cities, absolutely, they need a squad. They need a dedicated unit of experts. This is what they need to do. This is what they're focused on. Because if we get the upper hand in this situation, we're able to identify, track, hunt down these individuals that are still walking our streets. You know, the women and children especially are the ones that get to me the most. You know, the ones that are abducted, or held, tortured, you know, violated, it's unacceptable in our world, at least in mine. You know, I was raised, you protect your women and your children first off. And it really, really eats at me that these people are out here walking these streets. And I'm going to do everything within my power, and my company's going to do everything within their power to get them off the streets, to save the next individual.
And you had mentioned what led to this up and coming exoneration was a list of linguistics with serial killers that goes back to what, 1940s is what you said? Talk to me about developing that, what exactly it is.
Well, we started, 1944 is the very first letter that we retrieved. And over the years, it's taken many years, over a decade, we've sent out the FOIA requests, we've met with victims' families who have had their own personal evidence. Again, detectives have retired, passed on, their family members opened their files. We've uncovered these letters that some of the public has never seen in cases such as, say, the Zodiac case, the Circleville Rider case, the Atlanta child murder case, the Oakland County child murder cases. There's letters that the public do not know exist, which have information in them, which we've been able to upload into our database and cross-reference. And you would be surprised at the number of hits that we've had linguistically, especially on words, misspelling of words, phrases that are used that are uncommon. This is one of the things that James Fitzgerald did when he tracked down the Unabomber, is he used linguistics. And this man pioneered a new field in forensics that right now is paying off for us. And with our singular database, like I said, being in-house with us that we've created ourselves, we have access to information that other people do not. We have a collective. You know, the FBI may have their files, local agency may have their files, you know, state police may have their files, but we have a collection of all. So with that, we're able to cross-reference and connect these dots, and it's opening doors. And again, that's how we were able to identify the perpetrator in the Chicago Lipstick murders.
That is so incredible, because as you just said, these documents exist, but they're not all in the same place, right? You mentioned there are multiple different agencies that have them, but this puts it into one spot so that you're able to trace it back through an entire system. And that makes things much more efficient and beneficial for you guys in the long run.
Absolutely. If you have everything in one hard drive, you're able to pull it up and run the checks that we've done. I mean, we've had over, now this is kind of astonishing, but we've had over 282 hits on these letters. And a lot of people say, well, what does that mean? When we have a registered return on this, that means that one letter returned a hit on a different letter, which may be a completely different case. So the information within the two letters basically are connected, whether it be the same terminology, misspellings. There's a lot of stuff that goes into this that we've kind of created. We've evolved. You know, I have an IQ of 161. I'm a polymath and an autodidact. So I'm self-taught. I learn something new every single day. That's something I take great pride in. And, you know, this idea came to me that if we're able to create this database, that would give us an upper hand. And it has definitely paid off.
That's incredible. And so, Alex, on this podcast and on our series for Unsolved, we talk about cold cases and unsolved crime that have happened in the Western New York region, the surrounding Buffalo, New York area is really what we specialize in. Are there any cases that you have worked on, are looking at now, or are familiar with in the greater Western New York region?
Not in the Buffalo area necessarily, not at this time. No one's contacted us and we haven't really journeyed that far. I do have family in the Buffalo area, so I may be taking a vacation there in the near future. I may be looking into the local files to see what's up there and see if maybe we can assist some of these victims' families. Every family deserves answers. That's one of the things that I take great pride in. We do not pick and choose. If they reach out to us, we give 100% to each and every one of them. And, you know, one case that we can take off the table and close is one less family out there that is without answers.
But there is one case from Rochester, I believe, that you looked into, one that I had not heard of until we, you know, spoke prior to this interview about the Alphabet murders. When did you look into that case, and just talk to us a little bit about some of the details of it?
I began looking at that case approximately 3-4 years ago, the initial file. I pulled it back out after speaking with Morgan, and you know, we extended the offer to discuss this case, which is great. I think every case needs to be brought to light, especially the older ones that have kind of been forgotten. This case took place between November of 1971 to November of 1973, over a 2-year span. There was 3 young ladies. There was Carmen Colin, there was Wanda Witzke, and Michelle Meneza. They, if as you notice, each of them have the same first initial for their first and last name. And they were also left within a city or town that began with the same initial. So this was kind of unique, whether there's a correlation there or not, if it was just luck. I do not believe in circumstances, meaning that, you know, something is a coincidence, where if it happens 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times, there has to be a purpose. If it happens just once or twice, I can overlook that. You know, it's kind of like having a lightning rod. You know, lightning strikes in a while, but if you have a lightning rod that draws the electricity to it, then there's a purpose for that. Similar with these cases, that's how I look at them. So there's something here that we were able to uncover. We were tracking an individual across the nation who was relocating. He was murdering children. He was writing these letters. He was staging things, making the same MO, picking them up, feeding them, holding them for a day or two, extended period of time, sometimes up to 2 weeks, over 2 weeks, and then dropping their bodies off on the side of the road. It's not the first time a case like this has happened. It happened in DC for the Freeway Phantom from 71 to 72. It happened in Oakland County, Michigan for 76, 77. It happened in Atlanta from 79 to 81. And again, these are cases that we've uncovered new evidence in that we were able to link the individuals through forensic advancements.
And as I just said, I had not heard of that case, and that is a complex case that spans multiple states, and it has to be a lot to look into at one time.
It definitely is complex. It takes time. It takes great attention to detail, which my team is. We couldn't have a better team behind me. Without them, it would be very difficult for me to do even one of these cases. They are definitely the backbone, with my wife behind the company. I might be the front man. I might be the one that everybody claims is the brains, the American Sherlock, because of my genius intellect. But I got to tell you, without my team, and especially without my wife, I cannot be where I'm at today. But this case, this particular case in general, it's a sad situation, to the point to where after all these years, people like yourself do not even know that the case exists.
Alex, I got to ask you about a case that's still underway right now in our viewership. It's in Chautauqua County, which is like more rural, headed toward Pennsylvania here in like the Western New York area. For those of you who have just listened to our last podcast episode, I'm sorry, I'm just going to do a quick recap. For those of you who are more curious, you can go back to this previous episode, but I would like to get your take real quick, or your thoughts about it. Essentially, a hiker in Chautauqua County in September was looking for a lost item and stumbled across human remains. It was a human skull, and reported it to authorities. Forensic anthropologists on the scene had said that those remains had been there for around 30 years. While detectives and law enforcement were on the scene investigating those remains, a second set of human remains was found 10 feet away from the first set. And those remains had only been there less than 6 months. So just knowing those preliminary facts of the case, many people wondered whether or not it was a serial killer, or could have been the same person that committed both crimes. But given the amount of time that went by between each of the remains being placed there, just a lot going on. Right now, one of the remains, the ones that were only there for 6 months, was identified as a 50-year-old woman who was from Buffalo, which is about 35 minutes from where the remains were found. So, and the second set is still undergoing DNA identification at this time. But I would just be curious, a lot of people wondering if it could potentially be the same person, or if it just is a coincidence that two human remains were disposed in the same spot, 10 yards apart.
It would be difficult for me to make an evaluation or have a perception on this without knowing the case details, of course. I'm not sure how the elderly lady went missing. Was she reported missing? Was there any sign of her being abducted or physical or bodily harm? You know, I do not know the case details, but I can tell you this, the word or term serial killer is not something that law enforcement really likes to use without having hard evidence, physical evidence, real evidence, you want to call it, connecting an individual or connecting multiple homicides using forensics. So this is something that they're going to, of course, avoid unless there is hard evidence or physical evidence here that validates that claim. Is it possible? Absolutely. The individual that I've been tracking in one of these cases murdered over 54 years. 54 years over 28 states, he killed people. So this is, I mean, there's a lot. It's possible. Absolutely. Anything's possible. Let me rephrase that. Likelihood of 30 years apart, same location, highly unlikely that it would be a serial killer. But again, anything's possible.
Yeah, it just has been a case that's been getting so much attention right now that people are really interested in. And while I had your expertise here, I thought I would just get your insight. So I appreciate your thoughts on that. Is there any other cases that you are looking into or plan to look into that may be well known? I know you briefly had mentioned the Zodiac case. You mentioned other ones. Any indication of what else you may be looking to do?
Well, we have some new evidence in the DC Freeway Phantom case from 71-72. We have new physical evidence in the Acme murders, which could quite possibly exonerate Wayne Williams. So another man that has claimed his innocence all these years, and I was able to identify an individual that went to Atlanta, that was in Atlanta committing homicides with physical evidence at the crime scenes that I've uncovered, connecting this individual. And we also have, of course, the notorious Zodiac case that we've been working on, which we've uncovered new forensic evidence in this case, which is, this was one of those moments where, you know, when you get the registered return on it, you nearly fall out of your seat. So this was one of the bigger ones that we're going to be announcing here. And we've worked getting the files for the Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short, from 46 and 47, Los Angeles, which we've uncovered new evidence in that case. You know, I have the greatest team out there, at least in my opinion, of experts, and they are definitely earning their keep. They're pulling their weight. These individuals have literally dismantled these case files back to square one and started a new investigation. We call it reinvestigation rather than, you know, continuing the investigation that previously exists. We want to make sure that the public understands that we're starting from square one. We're not being influenced. We're not going off other people's opinions or assumptions. We're sticking strictly to the facts, the hard evidence, what we can touch, you know, feel, pick up, look at, run tests on. That's what we're looking at. And, you know, we're making strides, leaps and bounds here that are unprecedented. And we're excited about this.
It is awesome. Alex, if anybody is listening right now and they want to help, they know of a case that might be interesting, they want to reach out to you, how can they contact you? How can they assist you? Give us some of the details.
Well, you can go online for cccoa.us. That's our business website for the company. Again, it's cccoa.us. We have some other websites that are created beneath this website, which will work independently on cases like the Circleville Rider case. We just got back from Circleville, Ohio, uncovered some evidence there, interviewed some witnesses, went to the crime scene, and we're going to release our findings on that here in the next couple of weeks also. But that website is circlevillemystery.com. That's circlevillemystery.com if you want to look that up. And then we're on Twitter for CCCOA, Cold Case Consultants of America, and we're also on Facebook for CCCOA, Cold Case Consultants of America, LLC. So if you want to reach out to us, if you have cases that you would like our investigative team to take a look at, if you have any information that might be vital to another case, whether we're working on it or not, please reach out to us, because law enforcement has been opening their doors to us. They have been working with us on cases, which is unusual typically, but they've been very, open and appreciative of our work. And we would like to continue to assist them for the victims and for the answers and truth and ultimately justice.
Alex Bever, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Thank you for all that you are doing.
Leanne, thank you for having us. It's people like you that make a difference in this, just so you know, getting us on here, getting other agencies out there on the air, letting the public know what's going on, let them know these statistics and how we can resolve this issue collectively. So I want to thank you personally for having us here.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Unsolved True Crime in Western New York. I want to know what you think. Follow me on Twitter. My handle is @LeanneStock. What did you think of this interview? Any ideas for future interviews that you would like me to do? Let me know. I want to connect with you. But for now, we'll see you next time.